This is For the Record, program number 867. Because They Can, part 3, Fireside Rant about Technocratic Fascism as Cyber Crowleyism. This is being recorded on October 9th of the year 2015. This program is going to not only follow on and supplement For the Record programs numbers 865 and 866 and 859, but it is going to, time permitting anyway, allow me to rant a little bit. That is Dave Emeryism for Ruminate, about the nature of technocratic fascism and the new moniker under which fascism or corporatism, as Mussolini called it, is marching, and that is libertarianism, a very seductive term. Many people I know, as I mentioned in 866, have been attracted to the libertarian doctrine, not out of any desire to participate in repression or totalitarianism, but because their instincts are against such things. And yet, when we look at what lies behind the very seductive and marketable concept of libertarianism, what we see is something along the lines of what Aleister Crowley described as his ethic of do as thou wilt. Basically, do whatever the bleep you want. And that just is not viable in a civilized society, because there are things simply are not acceptable, and they are not acceptable because they do a tremendous amount of harm to other human beings. And I will begin once again with a very short excerpting and crystallization of a vitally important article by David Columbia from uncomputing.org. It's in the description and in many other programs. And Columbia writes, such technocratic beliefs are especially widespread in our world today, especially in the enclaves of digital enthusiasts, whether or not they are part of the giant corporate digital leviathan, hackers, civic, ethical, white, and black hat alike, hacktivists, WikiLeaks fans, and Julian Assange, anonymous members, even Edward Snowden himself walk hand in hand with Facebook and Google in telling us that coders don't just have good things to contribute to the political world, but that the political world is theirs to do with what they want, and the rest of us should just stay out of it. The political world is broken, they appear to think, rightly at least in part, and the solution to that, they think, wrongly, at least for the most part, is for programmers to take political matters into their own hands. Tor co-creator Dingledon, that's Roger Dingledon, asserts that a small group of software developers can assign themselves the role of exclusive guarantors of human rights, and that members of democratic polities have no choice but to accept them having that role. Further, it is hard not to notice that his appeal to natural rights is today most often associated with the political right for a variety of reasons. And that whole crystallization of that is not only in the description for the record 867, which will be available online later this evening, that is October 9th, It is already available in the descriptions for a number of different For the Record programs. You can just click the For the Record on the Spitfire website, Spitfire List website, and do a search for Golumbia. That's open quote Golumbia. In For the Record 866, we were talking about the development of, quote, smart contracts, basically using technology that was developed for Bitcoin, is applied to Bitcoin. And we took a look at some of the capabilities of the smart contract. And this, again, is discussed at considerable length in an article about the Ethereum, basically the technology that is being developed by Ethereum called Bitcoin's Dark Side Could Get Darker by Tom Simonetti of the MIT Technology Review of August 13th of 2015. And we have talked about that, some of the capabilities of this. And it, in addition to some of the ostensibly positive benefits, there are many things that could be useful for illegal activity, such as, one example is a contract offering a cryptocurrency reward for hacking a particular website. Ethereum's programming language makes it possible for the contract to control the promised funds. It will release them only to someone who provides proof of having carried out the job in the form of a cryptographically verifiable string added to the defaced site. Contracts with a similar design could be used to commission many kinds of crimes, say the researchers. Most provocatively, they outline a version designed to arrange the assassination of a public figure. A person wishing to claim the bounty would have to send information such as the time and place of the killing in advance. The contract would pay out after verifying that those details had appeared in several trusted newspapers such as Newswires. A similar approach could be used for lesser physical crimes such as high-profile vandalism. I would note, interjecting briefly, that I see nothing that would prevent a form of cyber terrorism, for example, using this same scenario to basically hire someone anonymously and pay someone anonymously to conduct some form of mass casualty terrorism, taking down a chemical plant or sabotaging the power grid or a nuclear power plant or two or three. I think the possibilities for serious mayhem here, just massive destruction, are considerable, and it is one of the reasons why, and many people may be shocked by the fact that I am supportive of the NSA vis-a-vis Snowden, just as I'm supportive of Russia vis-a-vis the Ukraine. That situation, by the way, appears to be accelerating and I think could very easily result in a third world war. I've talked about that in past programs. I believe the intelligence operation for which professional spy Edward Snowden is fronting actually is part of the Ukrainian op, the op that brought the OUND World War II era fascists back to power in Ukraine, or their heirs. How does someone defend against something like this? I don't know. I don't know if the NSA is up to the job, but the ACLU sure as hell isn't going to be up to the job, and failure to be up to the job is very likely to cost a great many people their lives. And one of the things that I find so alarming about the ethics at work. It's why I term technocratic fascism the sort of cyber Crowleyism, as Aleister Crowley said, do as thou wilt. And talking here about Gavin Wood, the chief technology officer of Ethereum, who is developing this. However, Wood acknowledges it is likely that Ethereum will be used in ways that break the law, and even says that is part of what makes the technology interesting. Just as file sharing found widespread unauthorized use and forced changes in the entertainment and tech industries, illicit activity enabled by Ethereum could change the world, he says. The potential for Ethereum to alter aspects of society is of significant magnitude, says Wood. This is something that would provide a technical basis for all sorts of social changes, and I find that exciting, skipping down. You can implement any web service without there being a legal entity behind it, he says. The idea of making certain things impossible to legislate against is really interesting. Well, it is indeed, and the almost erotic fascination that he obviously has for this, I find alarming, given the possibilities for horrible abuse of this technology. And the things that are, we'll talk about some of the implications of this for the economic realm a little bit later. Sort of resuming the line of analysis that we closed, for the record, 866 with. We were talking about Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to the Silicon Valley, and he was being oozed all over by all sorts of tech executives, and he was doing his little bowing and holding his hands together, and the almost orgasmic adoration that these tech executives had for him was evident, and to me at least, disgusting under the circumstances, as we looked at in, among other programs, for the record, 795. Narendra Modi is closely affiliated with the, well, he's a member of the BJP party in India, which is dominated by the RSS. That is a Hindu nationalist slash fascist organization, one of whose alumni assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. More about that later. I remember very distinctly the Apple headquarters had a gigantic, perhaps they still do, I haven't been by there in a while, but they had a large billboard visible from the freeway, and they would have their logo of Think Different, very visible, with people like Cesar Chavez and John Lennon and Albert Einstein. One of the people they had was Mahatma Gandhi, and now you have the luminaries of Silicon Valley oozing all over a fellow who comes from the political forces, is evolved from the political forces that murdered Mahatma Gandhi. As I noted at the end, for the record, 866, using the Ethereum technology, now Gandhi could be, or anyone else could be assassinated in complete anonymity with Bitcoin or some other digital currency available for the assassins, who would be able to then escape and preserve their anonymity. I don't know how you would counteract something like this. I don't know if NSA is up to the job, but somebody sure as bloody hell should be, given the technologies that are coming online, the senile ethic that is being marketed by the Republicans and the Libertarians of, well, we need smaller government and less regulation. In the past, 20 years or so, with the development of the internet, the weakification of society, and the development of mobile technology, we are in a completely different technological age. Now, when one or two people can basically wreak havoc on a society and do so anonymously, we are in something very different. Our concepts of civil liberties and the Bill of Rights actually are sadly largely technologically outmoded. The framers of the Constitution were worried about absolute monarchy. They were worried that a king like George III could simply impose his will on a society. And the Constitution was crafted in such a way as to preclude such a possibility. If the founders of the framers of the Constitution were able to reincarnate today, they would be horrified at the ability of our technology to basically enable a small number of people or even an individual to impose his or her lethal will on millions upon millions of people, and to do so anonymously and with impunity. Again, Gandhi could now be murdered using a smart contract and digital currency. They could do so in anonymity and would get away with it. Think different. That's different, all right. Namaste. Turning to Narendra Modi. Now, again, the ascension of Narendra Modi, as we looked at in For the Record 795, was enabled in considerable measure by Pierre Omidyar, the top dog at eBay, who also not only helped to finance the Maidan coup, which brought the OUNB fascists to power in Ukraine. One of his proteges there, Svetlana Zalashuk, is now helping to integrate Ukraine into NATO, or technologically coordinate Ukraine with NATO. I would note that Omidyar, as we looked at in For the Record 858, is now working directly with the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a cutout for U.S. intelligence for various kinds of overt, covert operations. And again, it was Pierre Omidyar who helped to bring Narendra Modi to power. He was deeply involved with helping to finance Narendra Modi's campaign. And I thought, by way of further highlighting the moral and philosophical bankruptcy that the free market philosophy that is beloved, I guess, by the tech mavens, certainly they were oozing all over Narendra Modi, and I think it is worth taking a look at the political will of this individual and just what is taking place. Now, those people who consider themselves to be libertarians and, you know, love Edward Snowden, who's basically not only a spook but a fascist, and Julian Assange falls into the same category. There is information in the description about the political views of Assange and Edward Snowden. By way of taking a look at the amorality, and I'm actually being fairly charitable there, of the people who are seeing Narendra Modi as a wonderful individual who can open up Indian markets to the tech companies, reviewing very quickly an article that we looked at in For the Record 851. One of the things that Modi's BJP government is working to do is to weaken India's child labor laws. This is by Rashme Sehgal, S-E-H-G-A-L, from the Quartz blog of May 4th of 2015. The Modi government is sending millions of kids back into exploitative labor. And the entire article is in the description for the Record 867, which will be available later today. Excerpting the story, an amendment to the Child Labor Prohibition Act proposed by the Narendra Modi-led government is about to undo years of hard-won progress in the area of child labor and condemn millions of kids to exploitative employment. Skipping down. If the BJP party succeeds in introducing such a dangerous amendment, we will be back to those old days. I suspect that part of what the tech companies have in mind in India is using dirt cheap labor to manufacture their various high-tech toys. Certainly, the successful rollback of India's child labor laws will lower wages for the entire workforce because they will be basically competing against what, for all intents and purposes, are slaves. And I've got a hunch that's what they have in mind. There are already plenty of cell phones and mobile devices in India. In any event, when you see Mark Zuckerberg just oozing all over Narendra Modi and these other tech executives behaving similarly, bear in mind what this guy is actually doing and consider the fundamental moral bankruptcy of what they are embracing and what Pierre Omidyar of eBay helped to promote. And consider the following. How libertarian does this sound? This is from the New York Times of October 2nd of 2015. India's attack on free speech by Sonia Falero of the New York Times. And this article reads, in today's India, secular liberals face a challenge, how to stay alive. In August, 77-year-old scholar M.M. Kalburgi, K-A-L-B-U-R-G-I, an outspoken critic of Hindu idol worship, was gunned down on his own doorstep. In February, the communist leader Govind Pansari was killed near Mumbai. And in 2013, the activist Narendra Dabolkar was murdered for campaigning against religious superstitions. These killings should be seen as the canary in the coal mine. Secular voices are being censored, and others will follow. While there have always been episodic attacks on free speech in India, this time feels different. The harassment is front-page news, but the government refuses to acknowledge it. Indeed, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's silence is being interpreted by many people as tacit approval, given that the attacks have gained momentum since he took office in 2014 and are linked to Hindutva groups whose far-right ideology he shares. Parenthetically, I would note that there also has been an apparent program of assassination of dissidents in Ukraine as well, bearing in mind that eBay's Pierre Omidyar, who also is bankrolling Glenn Greenwald's of journalistic ventures, even that Omidyar not only helped to bankroll the ascent of Modi, but also the ascent of the OUNB heirs in Ukraine. And we're now seeing basically political murder becoming a way of life in both countries. Returning now to the article about the attacks on free speech in India. Earlier this month, a leader of the Sri Ram Sena, S-R-I-R-A-M-S-E-N-E, three words, a Hindu extremist group with a history of violence, including raiding pubs and beating women they find inside, ratcheted up the tensions. He warned that writers who insulted Hindu gods were in danger of having their tongues sliced off. For those who don't support the ultimate goal of these extremists, a Hindu nation, Mr. Modi's silence is ominous. This is a turning point for India, a country that has taken pride in being a liberal democracy and that often adopts a high-minded tone when neighbors fall short of the same standards. When the liberal Pakistani politician Salman Taseer, T-A-S-E-E-R, was assassinated in 2011, the Indian journalist M.J. Akbar, now the national spokesman for the BJP party, chided, quote, "If Salman Taseer had been an Indian Muslim, he would still have been alive," unquote. In the run-up to the 2014 general elections in Bangladesh, India expressed concern over the fate of the country's democratic institutions. "We should be worrying instead about what's happening in India and recognize that it could go the way of the very neighbors it criticizes." As Nikhil, N-I-K-H-I-L, Wagle, W-A-G-L-E, a prominent liberal journalist based in Mumbai, told me, quote, "Without secularism, India is a Hindu Pakistan," unquote. The murders in India share striking similarities, and the killings of four Bangladeshi bloggers, this year. But while there was a global outcry over what happened in Bangladesh, India is hiding behind its patina of legitimacy granted by being the world's largest democracy. Like the murdered bloggers, the Indian victims held liberal views, but were neither famous nor powerful. Mr. Kalburgi, K-A-L-B-U-R-G-I, had publicly expressed skepticism toward idol worship in Hinduism, but didn't pose a threat to anyone. While the authorities are pursuing the culprits on a case-by-case basis, the overarching attack on free speech has not been addressed. The threats and killings have created an atmosphere of self-censorship and fear. Some of the killers are still on the loose, while on one hand they wield a gun, in the other they wave a list. On September 20, Mr. Wagle, W-A-G-L-E, again the journalist, learned from a source that intercepted phone calls had revealed that members of yet another right-wing Hindu group, Sanatan Santha, that's S-A-N-A-T-A-N, S-A-N-S-T-H-A, had marked him as their next victim. The extremists who celebrated the August murder of Mr. Kalburgi were more direct. They used Twitter to warn K.S. Bhagwan, B-H-A-G-W-A-N, a retired university professor who is critical of the Hindu caste system, that he would be next. The goal of transforming India from a secular state to a Hindu nation, which seems to be behind the murders, is abetted not just by the silence of politicians, but also by the Hindu nationalist policies of the ruling BJP. Over the past few months, the government has purged secular voices from high-profile institutions, including the National Book Trust and the Independent Board of Nalanda University. That's N-A-L-A-N-D. I am probably mispronouncing many of these names. The government is not replacing mediocre individuals. The chancellor of Nalanda was the Nobel laureate Amartya Sen, A-M-A-R-T-Y-A-S-E-N. The government is replacing luminaries with people whose greatest qualification is faith in the Hindutva ideology. The new appointees are rejecting scientific thought in favor of religious ideas that have no place in secular institutions. One of the government's chief targets is the legacy of India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, who laid the foundation for a secular nation. Last month, having nudged out the director of the Nehru Museum and Library in New Delhi, the government announced plans to rename the museum and change its focus to highlight the achievements of Mr. Modi. This is akin to repurposing the Washington Monument as an Obama museum. In addition to erasing the contributions of long-dead liberals, BJP leaders are busy promoting violent Hindu nationalists. Sakshi Maharaj, S-A-K-S-H-A, last name M-A-H-A-R-A-J, a BJP member of parliament, described Nataram Godse, the man who assassinated Mahatma Gandhi, as a, quote, patriot, unquote. Although Mr. Maharaj later retracted his statement, his opinion is shared by many of his party colleagues. Gandhi's assassin, again, Nataram, N-A-T-H-U-R-A-M, Godse, G-O-D-S-E, was a former member of the RSS, an armed Hindu group with which Mr. Modi has been associated since he was 8 years old. The BJP's efforts to reshape institutions that embody secular values, values they dismiss as Western, unquote, was certainly anticipated. It came as no surprise when the Culture and Tourism Minister, Mahesh Sharma, recently promised to, quote, cleanse every area of public discourse that had been westernized, unquote. Mr. Sharma is well aware of the connotations of the word he used. It's also not surprising that Hindu fundamentalists would feel empowered in the shadow of a Hindu nationalist government. Still, few expected that freedom of speech would become as a contestable commodity and that some who exercised it would lose their lives. The realization has made for decisions that were once unthinkable in India. Last December, the acclaimed author Perumal Murugan, P-E-R-U-M-A-L-M-U-R-U-G-A-N, informed the police that he received threats from Hindu groups angered by a novel he wrote in 2010. Extremists staged burnings of his book and demanded a public apology from him. The police suggested he go into exile. Realizing he was on his own in January, Mr. Murugan announced the withdrawal of his entire literary canon. On Facebook, he swore to give up writing, in essence, apologizing for his life's work out of fear for his family's safety. Again, I contrast this with the Salman Rushdie phenomenon and the support he was given. We don't hear much about this, do we? And note how Mr. Murugan announced the withdrawal of his entire literary oeuvre. On Facebook, he swore to give up writing, in essence apologizing for his life's work out of fear for his family's safety. That's the same Facebook headed up by Mark Zuckerberg, who is oozing all over Narendra Modi just a couple of weeks ago. It's hard to accept what is happening in India. It is easier to ignore or dismiss the attacks and the threats as a liberal persecution complex or a phase that will last only as long as the BJP is in power. But the country is undergoing a tectonic shift that will have long-term repercussions. The attacks in India should not be seen as a problem limited to secular writers or liberal thinkers. They should be recognized as an attack on the heart of what constitutes a democracy, and that concerns everyone who values the idea of India as it was conceived and as it is beloved, rather than an India imagined through the eyes of religious zealots. Indians must protest these attacks and demand accountability from people in power. We must call for all voices to be protected before we lose our own. And following that up, yet another article from the New York Times. This from the New York Times of October 5th of 2015. By the way, the other article, I believe, was on October 4th, maybe October 2nd. I'll have to double-check that. It was in last Sunday's New York Times. This is an article co-authored by David Barstow, B-A-R-S-T-O-W, and Suhasini Raj, S-U-H-A-S-I-N-I, last name R-A-J, from the New York Times of October 5th of 2015. India politics are backdrop in mob attack. The vigilantes from Save the Cows sprang into action the moment they heard a rumor that a cow's slaughtered remains had been found near an electrical transformer looming over the heart of this village. They quickly raised the alarm through text messages and phone calls. A local Hindu priest was asked to alert villagers from his temple loudspeaker. Soon, about 1,000 men had gathered by the transformer. There was no sign that a cow, a holy symbol for Hindus, had been slaughtered. Nevertheless, the men proceeded through zigzagging alleys to the home of the suspected cow killer, Mohammed Ikhlaq, I-K-H-L-A-Q, one of the few Muslims living in this village about 30 miles east of New Delhi. Mr. Ikhlaq and his wife, Ikraman, I-K-R-I-M-A-N, were on their second-floor patio, dozing after dinner and prayers. Suddenly their home was swarming with men. Mrs. Ikhlaq heard someone shout, "Kill them!" She, her husband, and their son, Danish, 20, retreated inside behind a thick wooden door. The mob shattered the door. "What's the matter?" Mrs. Ikhlaq cried out. An incredulous voice replied from the dark, "After slaughtering a cow, you are asking us what's the matter?" Men began to paw at Mrs. Ikhlaq, so she bit hard into a sweaty hand, broke free, and fled downstairs. "Too scared even to breathe," she said in an interview. Upstairs, the mob bludgeoned her husband with her sewing machine and smashed her son's head with a brick. Then they dragged Mr. Ikhlaq down 14 cement steps and out to the main road by the transformer, where he was left for all to see. Mr. Ikhlaq was declared dead early Tuesday morning, hours after the attack. His son remains in critical condition. But in interviews last week, more than a half dozen members of Save the Cow expressed little remorse for what happened at the Ikhlaq's home. Instead, they blamed Mr. Ikhlaq for inciting the mob's fury by slaughtering and eating a cow, an allegation dismissed by the Ikhlaq family and the police, who have filed murder charges against 10 men. By the way, parenthetically, of course, cows are sacred in India. Skipping down. Many leaders of Save the Cow here are also prominent local organizers in Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party, which is vying to oust the socialist party that leads Uttar Pradesh, a vast northern state with more than 200 million residents, including the 20,000 in this village. Mr. Tomar, 24, for example, is the general secretary of the local BJP youth wing. Mr. Nagar, 33, is the state secretary of the BJP youth wing. By the week's end, they and many other BJP leaders were blaming the governing party in Uttar Pradesh for the attack in Bisada. That's B-I-S-A-D-A. Save the Cow and BJP leaders here have also roundly condemned the decision by the police to bring murder charges. In their view, the death of Mr. Ikhlaq was at most the unintended byproduct of a chaotic, highly charged situation of his own making. Quote, "He slipped and his head hit the road and he died," Mr. Tomar said, adding, "These things happen. It's a mob," unquote. It's kind of like Jeb Bush discussing the Roseburg, Oregon massacre, saying stuff happens. The BJP, as we have noted, is basically dominated by the RSS, which pretty much runs Narendra Modi, as we looked at in For the Record 866. And the RSS is a Hindu nationalist and fascist party, one of whose alumni killed Mahatma Gandhi. Once again, speaking of Mr. Ikhlaq, a Muslim, and again, therefore Hindus, cows are sacred in India, "He slipped and his head hit the road and he died," Mr. Tomar said, adding, quote, "These things happen. It's a mob." Mr. Modi's culture minister, Mahesh Sharma, who represents this area in the Indian parliament, went so far as to tell the Indian Express that Mr. Ikhlaq's death, quote, should be considered as an accident, unquote. Well, that, that I think speaks for itself, and this basically is what is going on in India under Narendra Modi, and this is the kind of governance that is being celebrated by the mavens of big tech when Narendra Modi came to the Silicon Valley. And we should note basically what the economic philosophy of Edward Snowden is. I've spoken about that in the past, including in, for the record, 831. Basically, he is a devotee of the economic philosophies of Ron Paul. And he favors getting rid of Social Security, a return to the gold standard. He has attacked the bailout program as debasing the currency. Basically, he is an advocate of just exactly the types of right-wing economic philosophy, the type of right-wing economic philosophy embodied by the Republican Party. In the New Republic of January 19th, 2014, an article by Sean, S-E-A-N, Wilentz, W-I-L-E-N-T-Z, would you feel differently about Snowden, Greenwald, and Assange if you knew what they really thought? And again, talking about Assange, at the time this, about Snowden, rather. At the time the stimulus bill was being debated, Snowden also condemned Obama's economic policies as part of a deliberate scheme, quote, to devalue the currency absolutely as fast as theoretically possible. The social dislocations of the financial collapse bothered him not at all. Almost everyone was self-employed prior to 1900, he asserted. Why is 12% unemployment so terrifying? And then he talked about Social Security. Want to save money? Cut this Social Security BS. And by the way, I'm going to have to attenuate a lot of the language because we are on the radio. Skipping down. Somehow, our society managed to make it hundreds of years without Social Security just fine. Magically, the world changed after the New Deal, and old people became made of glass. Later in the same session, Snowden wrote that the elderly, quote, wouldn't be effing helpless if you weren't sending them effing checks to sit on their A-blank-blanks and lay in hospitals all day. And I will also note, contrasting, and Julian Assange is a bird of the same feather, favoring free market economics, an advocate of Bitcoin, and he also has a eugenics philosophy that appears to derive from the fascist mind control cult The Family, or the Santa Kitana Park Association that we talked about in, for the record, 724. From Unseen, Unheard, Unknown by Sarah Moore. Many ex-sect members have said that they were aware that Anne Hamilton Byrne, the sect leader parenthetically, was creating children by a breeding program in the late 1960s. These were invisible kids because they had no papers and there is no proof that they ever existed. Yet we Hamilton Byrne children had multiple identities. These identities could perhaps have been loaned to other children, and the similarity of our appearance used to cover up their absence. One little blonde kid looks very much like another in a passport photo. We were the ones who would carry on the work of the sect. We were a direct reflection on her, so she was intimately concerned about our appearances. Anne Hamilton Byrne used to talk a lot about the breeding and talk about us being from the right stock, unquote. And that's basically the worldview expressed by Julian Assange. Reading from Inside WikiLeaks, My Time with Julian Assange at the World's Most Dangerous Website by Daniel Domscheit-Berg, published in hardcover by Crown Publishers in 2011. Speaking of he and Assange, we often discuss the theory of evolution. If he did have faith in anything, it was the theory of evolution. Julian thought that the stronger members of the species not only prevailed, but produced heirs who were better able to survive. Naturally, in his view, his genes particularly deserved to be reproduced. Often I sat in larger groups and listened to Julian boast about how many children he had fathered in various parts of the world. He seemed to enjoy the idea of lots and lots of little Julians, one on every continent. Whether he took care of any of these alleged children or whether they existed at all was another question. What strikes me is that with Julian Assange and his attitude of passing on his superior genes all around the world, he sort of sees himself as Julian Applesperm, and with Edward Snowden and his desire to get rid of the useless bread gobblers, the elderly, quote, wouldn't be effing helpless if you stopped sending them effing checks so they could lay around in hospitals on their A-blank-blanks. You basically have the polarities of the Nazi eugenics philosophy, with Snowden embodying the T4 euthanasia program, get rid of the useless bread gobblers, and with Julian Assange, yes, we need to propagate the superior genes as much as possible. I will also note that Julian Assange is a big fan of Bitcoin, and Bitcoin derives from the same neoliberal economic philosophy that is espoused by the Republicans and that helped to bring about the collapse of 2008. Very quickly, from Diginomics of September 6th of 2015, by someone who calls himself Travis Patron, cryptocurrency taxation may subvert national collection. As the age of cryptocurrency comes into full force, it will facilitate a subversively viable taxation avoidance strategy for many of the technically savvy users of peer-to-peer cryptographic payment systems. In doing so, cryptocurrency use will actually erode the tax revenue base of national jurisdictions and ultimately reposition taxation as a voluntary pay-for-performance function. Skipping down. Make no mistake, in a crypto-anarchist jurisdiction where there is no means to confiscate or control property on behalf of another individual, the need for the state will cease to exist. Mass taxation on digital currency is not feasible through judicial enforcement, while individual enforcement is bound to prove ineffective. You or anyone motivated to retain their net worth will find a subversively lucrative tax haven in the realm of cryptocurrency. And I would note that the newest, in response to a certain extent to the, quote, disclosures, unquote, by Edward Snowden, Wall Street is now embracing the Symphony Messaging Service. And that is an end-to-end encrypted messaging service that many people see as probably getting ready to shield the Wall Street from any scrutiny by regulators. That, again, is in keeping with the neoliberal economic philosophy to which Edward Snowden subscribes and to which the Republican Party subscribes, and frankly, that underlies Bitcoin and an awful lot of the technocratic fascism that I have been addressing. By the way, now there are indications that the basic technology, the software involved with Symphony, is going to expand to other industries as well, which may very well make them opaque to regulatory bodies. Note the following, and consider this again in the context of the neoliberal economic philosophy espoused by Edward Snowden, and that underlies Bitcoin, and that is part and parcel to technocratic fascism, or libertarian fascism, or what I call cyber cronyism. Do as thou wilt. We're going to wind up with this article from MarketWatch of August 14th of 2015. It's by Francine McKenna, M-C, capital K-E-N-N-A. Wall Street's new chat service is deleting problematic messaging. For a startup that says it's focused on secure messaging, Synthony has been deleting a lot of its own messaging to the public about what it provides for its financial services clients. The firm has been editing out references on its website to data deletion and its ability to help banks keep their data away from the government. The New York Post has previously reported that Synthony deleted a video from its website that bragged that its software could help banks avoid billions in fines by making data deletion easier. Continuing its efforts, Synthony has recently deleted a section about data security from its website and additional references that emphasize more privacy via data encryption and permanent data deletion capabilities. These were among the removed comments. End-to-end encryption. Synthony is completely private. Your data is 100% encrypted by encryption keys, protected by encryption keys, known only by you and never by us. Guaranteed data deletion. Synthony has designed a specific set of procedures to guarantee that data deletion is permanent and fully documented. A blog post from July entitled "To Encrypt or Not to Encrypt" is also now gone. That post included a passage touting its encryption capabilities as a way to protect firms' privacy. Our government officials are concerned that their inability to monitor end-to-end encrypted devices inhibits their role in keeping America safe. Conversely, Americans are concerned about preserving their right to privacy, and encryption helps individuals enforce that right, read the Post. Again, note the following here. Something that I read earlier. Note that the New York Post has previously reported that Synthony deleted a video from its website that bragged that its software could help banks avoid billions in fines by making data deletion easier. The firms, by the way, the economic firms that are involved with Synthony reads like a who's who of the companies that were involved in the 2008 collapse: Citicorp, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and just about everybody else, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank. And these are the firms that are subscribing to Synthony. And the website bragged its software could help banks avoid billions in fines by making data deletion easier. And basically, these are the banksters who brought about the 2008 financial collapse. And now, as a result of the technology stemming from the alarm over Edward Snowden's disclosure, basically, Americans are concerned, as it says here, Americans are concerned about preserving their right to privacy. Now, they are going to be able to avoid regulatory scrutiny. And in the same post, one of the very few people, one of my personal heroes, who has been raising hell about this is, not surprisingly, Elizabeth Warren. We're going to wrap up on Monday. Senator Elizabeth Warren stepped up the pressure on the firm as the Massachusetts Democrats sent a letter to 6 financial regulators raising concerns about Symphony's description of its new system, quote, which appears to put companies on notice with a wink and a nod that they can use Synthony to reduce compliance and enforcement concerns. Yes, indeed, cyberquilism, do as thou wilt. I would recommend that people who would like to get some additional perspective on Synthony, again, the people the firms using that read like a who's who of the firms that were instrumental in the deliberate manipulation of these bogus investment vehicles that produced the 2008 financial collapse: Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, Citicorp, Credit Suisse, J.P. Morgan, and they are now going to have their communications encrypted so they can avoid billions in fines. Again, that's what I call technocratic fascism or libertarian fascism or cyber cronyism. Do as thou wilt. This concludes For the Record program number 867, Because They Can, part 3, Reflections on Technocratic Fascism, or Fireside Rant about Technocratic Fascism and Cybercruelism. This is being recorded on October 9th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.